Good afternoon. We're going to get started. I would like to welcome all of you to the Lowell Reed Lecture Spiegelman and Statistics Section Awards session. My name is Amy Furkatich. I am chair of the Statistics Section for another couple of days. And then Jeffrey Wilson will be taking over. So again, I welcome all of you here. We're going to start with the award of the Spiegelman Award. And Dr. Nilanjan Chatterjee will come up and present that award.
It's my real honor to present the prestigious Spiegelman Award for 2012 to Sudipto Banerjee. So Sudipto got his bachelor's degree in statistics from Presidency College in Calcutta, India, and then master's of statistics from Indian Statistical Institute, also in Calcutta. And then he got his PhD from University of Connecticut under supervision of Professor Gelfand. And since then, he has been in the University of Minnesota in the Department of Biostatistics, where he has quickly risen through ranks of assistant professor to associate professor and to full professor. Sudipto has a spectacular record, whatever way you look at his CV. He has more than 60 publications, many in top-tier statistical journals, like Journal of the American Statistical Associations, NIH NSF grants as PI, and he has mentored a number of PhD students already. And Sudipto has made a deep and broad contributions in Bayesian modeling, spatial analysis, and environmental research, which has potential to impact public health. A number of these contributions actually involve fundamentally new ideas, such as spatial boundary analysis, spatial gradient, and co-regularization ideas. And not only that, he has brought fundamental ideas. Actually, he has made a tremendous effort to put this idea into practice. So he has actually written some of the most popular software for spatial data analysis, like the SP-based package that is used in R. And also, after doing all of this, he also had the time to write one of the most popular book in spatial statistics. And that's together with his colleagues, Brad Carlin and Alan Gelfand. He is the lead author of that book on spatial analysis. Sudipto has been already honored by his because of his contribution to environmental statistics by the Society of Environmental Statistics, but the Adwell L. Sarawadi Award. And he's also a great citizen for our community, for both statistics, environment, and epidemiology. He's the associate editor for 6 different journals. He has done his services to NIH and NSF by various serving on various grant review panels. And so I would say, just in summary, that Sudipto is one of the exemplary researchers in the field today, and because of his fundamental contribution to spatial statistics and environmetrics, and that has potential to impact public health. And he is going to bring more prestige to this already prestigious award, Spiegelman Award. Thank you. Come on, Sudipto.
Just wanted to say thank you very, very, very much to the Statistics Section of the American Public Health Association, to the Awards Committee, and I think it is an absolute privilege and a very, very humbling experience for me to be nominated for this award. I wanted to especially thank Nilanjan, who's a role model, and I see that I join a very illustrious group of statisticians before me, so that makes it all the more humbling. I do want to... My wife told me that, don't make this like an Oscar speech. But I think it would be remiss if I do not thank my collaborators, my mentors, my teachers, my advisor, Alan Gelfand, and then subsequently Brad Carlin, with whom I have worked a lot, so my students, from whom I have learned immensely, and my family and extended family, my parents, and of course, last but not the least, my wife, for her unwavering support and for being there for me when I was not around. I was traveling or even when I was physically absent or mentally absent, which is quite often the case for statisticians. So thank you so very much. It's a real pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, now I would like to present the two statistics section awards. The first award, the academic award, goes to Dr. Cheryl Addy. Dr. Addy has a bachelor's degree in mathematics from Furman University, an MS and PhD in biostatistics from Emory University, and she has been on the faculty at the University of South Carolina in the Department of Epidemiology and Biostatistics since 1988. She is currently the senior associate dean for academic affairs at the Arnold School of Public Health. Over the years, her research has focused on health issues in adolescents and women, and she is currently involved in research that is focused on physical activity targeting youth and minority populations. She has advised numerous PhD and master's students over the years, and she has been on dozens of student advisory committees, so that really speaks to her teaching abilities. She's been a reviewer for many public health and medical journals, and she has been actively involved in the Association for Schools of Public Health. She's currently co-chair of the Biostatistics Council in ASPH. She has been a member on several CEF site visit teams. And in 1997, she received the Distinguished Service Award from the American Statistical Association. And she has been an APHA member since 1990. So, Dr. Addy, on behalf of the statistics section, I'm honored to present to you the academic award, the statistics section.
I was not warned I was supposed to make remarks in response, but I do thank you, all of you, for doing this. It certainly is an honor to do this. Of course, at our last administrative council meeting, they started asking what was the probability of winning. And then I had to provide confidence intervals, so someone's not offered that. yes. But it certainly is a pleasure. I have certainly had a non-traditional career for biostat in that I moved to administration far too early. But it is certainly a pleasure to be recognized out of the field of biostatistics for what I have accomplished over the last 20-some years. So thank you very much.
And our second section award goes to Dr. Donna Hoyert. She is a health statistician in the Division of Vital Statistics at the National Center for Health Statistics. Unfortunately, she couldn't be with us today, but Dr. Deven Ingram will receive the award on her behalf.
Thank you. Donna regretted that she couldn't be here. She had a conflicting meeting that she had to attend to present results for vital statistics, so unfortunately she wanted very much to be here but could not. So I accept this plaque with her gratitude and thanks.
And now I have three appreciation awards to give. The first award goes to Jerry Arnold. Is Jerry here? I guess he might be in another session. So this award is given to Jerry. He's our secretary this year, and he has agreed to serve as a second term as secretary. So this is just to thank him for agreeing to that extra year of service and to organizing the section dinner again this year. So I'll give that to him later. And the second appreciation award goes to Deden. And this is in appreciation for her assistance with the efforts in the section procedures manual and Spiegelman guidelines. We spent a lot of time this summer making revisions to those manuals and for always responding to my emails and helping me with the section activities. So, Stephen. Thank you. Okay, and the third award goes to Bethany Head. And this is in appreciation for her leadership with the student competition. She made a great effort these past couple of years working on the student competition. I know the students are very appreciative as well. And for organizing our booth the second year in a row. So thank you very much for all of your activities. And Bethany is actually going to stay up here and present the certificates to the students who participated in the competition.
thank you, and it's been a pleasure to work with the section, so I appreciate the opportunity. So this year we had, I believe, the largest application number of applicants for the student competition, and I think one of the judges at the end of the presentation section said, you know, if this is the future of biostats, we're in really good hands. The quality of the presentations, the posters, the applicants was really superb, and I know I've learned a lot in being involved in the competition, and I want to thank the students for being involved as well. I did bring, just as a plug for next year, I did bring flyers on the student competition. So for those of you who work with students, I certainly encourage you to make this known to them as an opportunity. I think maybe to talk to the students who competed this year, we've really tried to engage them and make sure they have a chance to interact with mentors and potential future colleagues. So with that, I want to give out certificates to all the students who traveled here to participate in the student competition. I know some of them had conflicting sessions that they were going to, and actually many of them had to return back to their home institution. So I'll call out all the names, and for those of you who are here, I would invite you to come up and accept them. So Justin Dickerson. And I'm going to just stand here and talk very loudly. Donna Doblar, and I don't think Donna is here. Martin Dunbar. Lauren Hund. Robin Jeffries. Kui Feng Lee. I don't think it's here. Shannon McClintock. Ashley Pierre Saint, who I don't think is here. Martha Scupp. Ram Varma, who I don't think was able to come. And Shonda Vereen, who also was not able to come. So many of the students, including those here, but also the ones who were not able to come to this session, will be at the business meeting. And again, it's been a real joy to learn from them, so I certainly encourage you to interact with them and get to know them better. And now Amy will announce the winners of the two.
Okay, so the presentation winner is Lauren Hund. And the poster winner is Donna Debler. She's not here. Okay, well, let's give Donna. Okay. All right, now it is my honor to present to you the Lowell Reed lecturer, Dr. Dennis Gillings. Dr. Gillings received his bachelor's and PhD in mathematics from the University of Exeter. He served on the faculty at UNC in the Department of Biostatistics from 1971 to 1988. And in 1982, he founded Quintiles. He's currently serving as chairman and CEO of that organization. He has served on numerous boards and advisory committees over the years, including the University of Southampton Board of Trustees, the Graduate Education Advancement Board at UNC, and the Research, Innovation, and Enterprise Council. Over the years, he has received many honorary degrees and awards, including the Entrepreneur of the Year Award in 2003 by the Council for Entrepreneurial Development, and he was listed as one of the top 100 most inspiring people in life sciences by PharmaVoice in 2005. He has collaborated with many federal agencies, the Institute of Medicine, Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Carolina, among others. So it is my honor to present Dr. Gillings.
Excellent. Well, thank you, and good afternoon, everyone. It is a pleasure to be here. I was a little surprised to get this invitation because I don't give very many statistics lectures these days, but it's nice to be asked, and I was delighted to put some remarks together, trying to think through, where the field could be going, perhaps from a slightly different point of view than many of you may work in. So, I think statistics is in the golden age. It's the age of information. And to paraphrase Samuel Coleridge's Ancient Mariner, he was an English poet, water, water everywhere, and not a drop to drink. There's data, data everywhere, but we need statisticians to think. Google is trying to capture and organize all of the world's information in a whole mass of petabytes. And more than ever, we need biostatisticians to manage not only data, but use their minds, as I said. Modeling and simulation may be a driving force in our biostatistics and healthcare future. Now, I'd like to comment. The last statistics lecture I gave was actually 11 years ago. I gave it to the American Statistical Association, and I was invited. It was the presidential address. And at that time, I talked about the evolution of statistics. It actually started out as a political science word, status. But during the first half of the 20th century, it really became a scientific discipline that in the second half of the 20th century became a mathematics discipline. And I think in this century, it's becoming an information discipline. And so statisticians, I think, more and more need to be information scientists. And I think modeling and simulation will help drive biostatistics to become a greater information factory. Now, let me give some illustrations, and I'll give a number of illustrations through this talk. I believe innovation begins with a what if, and here we go back a few thousand years. We imagine an outcome, we execute many iterations, and if we've asked the right questions, we eventually achieve it. Now, think about aeronautics. The ancient aspiration to fly is at least as old as the Greek myth about Icarus. His father was a great inventor, observed birds in flight, and made mechanical wings of feathers and wax. But he had insufficient data, lacked the knowledge of physics, of lift and thrust, failed to account for the heat generated by the sun, and a material failure of melting wax ended in Icarus falling to his death. Now let's jump a couple of thousand years to 1903, the Wright brothers. They understood airspeed, lift, and control. They began with a kite in 1899, tested several iterations of gliders, built a wind tunnel for testing, since full-size wings and gliders were too expensive, and simulated wing shapes and propellers. The first powered manned flight was airborne for 59 seconds and flew 852 feet. Now, 100 years later, Boeing had data plus Cray supercomputers to design the 787 Dreamliner, and that's been in high publicity lately. There were 800,000 computer-based simulation hours that went into the design. Boeing built and flew the 787 after testing only 11 wing prototypes, compared to 77 that were used to build the 767. It was 20% lighter, 20% reduced emissions, and has a range of almost 10,000 miles. And simulation and modeling help to bring those statistics about. Now let's move to medicine, which is obviously a little closer to biostatistics. In medicine, the motivation is, I believe, more urgent even. It's a matter of life and death. We've been observing and amassing data and testing outcomes for untold generations, and gradually with success. Now go back to the 1790s. Edward Jenner observed the preventive effect of cowpox, tested cowpox inoculation in one patient an 8-year-old boy and demonstrated the prevention of smallpox. Now, 150 years later, Sir Austin Bradford Hill added a powerful new tool, randomization. Now, before Bradford Hill, clinical trials were not randomized to eliminate bias. But he used experimental design, randomization, and analysis of variants that was pioneered by Sir Ronald Fisher. Now, biostatistics remains at the heart of our ability to evaluate drugs and indeed medicine as a whole and be reasonably confident that the medicines will have acceptable levels of safety and effectiveness. So let's now jump a little bit to medicine today. A large part of expenditure on medical research is in the pharmaceutical and diagnostics industries. Clinical development of drugs takes 3 to 7 years, that's just the clinical part, in human beings, or longer. Costs $1 billion or more, and the success rate now has declined to just 8%. That's slightly around 1 in 12 for all candidates that first enter a human being. In healthcare delivery, we lack population-level safety evaluation in many, many instances, and we lack population-level treatment outcomes, particularly as it relates to comparative effectiveness. And this is in a climate where the U.S. healthcare expenditures have now reached almost 18% of gross domestic product. That is growing. The value is being questioned. The budgets are coming under enormous pressure. And I think that's evident at some of these meetings because people's budgets to attend these meetings tend to be declining. Let's jump to medicine tomorrow. What if we could screen potential drugs in virtual biosystems, evaluate therapies in virtual patients, and predict real-world health outcomes and costs? Now, you may say, well, that is a grand vision, and I think it is a grand vision, but if we go back to the aeronautical example, going from Icarus and then to the Wright brothers and now to the Dreamliners, I think the 787, I do think it's rather plausible that jumping from where we are today to the 3 points I've just made may be vastly possible. And let me stimulate that further by one view of the future of healthcare modeling and simulation. Now, what you are going to look at is a beating heart, an organoid creating by the researchers at the University of Minnesota, which is where I think the Spiegelman Award winner is at. And so you may know this beating heart even more than me. They stripped out the cells from a rat heart to leave a scaffold, reclothed the scaffold with stem cells, and supported the living heart via an artificial blood supply sustained in a bioreactor. So let's have a look at a little video.
This is no sci-fi flick. U.S. researchers say they've grown a beating heart in a lab.
We really have the audacity to claim to build a functional organ from scratch, so to speak.
They washed away the cells from the hearts of dead rats. Then they injected a gelatin-like scaffold with heart cells from newborn rats. 8 days later, the hearts began to pump. Dr. Doris Taylor of the University of Minnesota hopes to someday create new organs this way.
What we've done is hopefully open a door to the idea that we can actually begin to build not just pieces of tissue and organs, but build organs.
Another scientist said Taylor came up with an ingenious method. She basically gave nature the tools and let nature take its course. Fred Kandayama, Reuters, New York.
So that, I think, is amazing. I think we're probably not so far off real live livers. Work is certainly underway to create models of sustainable humanized hearts, lungs, and kidneys, as well as livers. And the potential uses are disease modeling and drug testing, but also organ transplantation. Now let's take this what if now and give some examples, because I'd like now to illustrate some of my remarks by a series of examples. First, let's expand our horizons by going a little broader and deeper, and then look at several examples and case studies of modeling and simulation, and then try to speculate a little more about the future view. So, we'll start with some expanding our horizons, and I mean now by expanding horizons, the horizons of statisticians. I do think, certainly in the era I grew up, a statistician was more studying mathematics and closed in on either artificial data sets or certainly data sets in a narrow frame of reference. I think what we need to recognize, and I'm sure many of you today who have been trained in a more modern era perhaps, recognize hugely expanding databases via the internet and the entire proliferation of data. It wasn't so much those statisticians that have generated searches. I think Google might be credited with doing the best searches, though. And databases will require a lot of search mechanisms, and then in turn, a lot of sophisticated analytics, primarily on observational type data rather than necessarily experimental data. And that will give us, I believe, the greatest movement in the proliferation of knowledge. And that will also require a lot of automation of techniques through screening techniques. And I think the Google search routine is an example of more of the things that statisticians will begin to develop. And from all this, simulations to a greater degree and modeling will follow. Now, I do believe the necessity of this is going to be driven at least as much by budgetary implications as anything else. Evidence-based medicine is certainly terminology that I use, and it may be widespread terminology, for how more and more decisions in medicine are going to have to be made. And this may involve evidence-based design of drugs, evidence-based therapeutic evaluation, and evidence-based policy and economics. And that is because the sheer unaffordability of healthcare as a whole, and also in the pharmaceutical sector, which is a highly profitable sector, shareholders are balking at the further investment because the investment is not productive enough. And so determining more ways to develop many of these things in a different environment through modeling and simulation is clearly a way we can move. Now, if one takes the clinical side of the development of products that go into human beings, I think there's an evolution that's taking place at the present time that reflects some of these remarks. The one is going a lot deeper. I tend to refer to this myself as more molecular medicine, understanding the molecular pathways of disease causality. But at the same time, many things are also going broader, and understanding real-world outcomes with large population databases and data analytics. And it's actually in both these directions simultaneously we need more data and more modeling and more simulation. Now let's talk about going deeper into genetics. The genetics revolution is really transforming our view of disease. The old view really was that disease was seen as a collection of symptoms. The new view that we're beginning to see is disease as a constellation of changes in a person's biomolecular network of genes, proteins, and biochemical pathways. Very different view of disease. And of course, this gives rise to a new approach to medicine, intervention at the molecular level through gene therapy, stem cell therapy, and regenerative medicine and tissue re-engineering. But of course, all that gets amplified with our ability to model and simulate. One very good example of targeted therapeutics is Herceptin, which really revolutionized the whole notion of drug development, not only because of its efficacy in breast cancer, but also because it targeted just 25% of women with breast cancer, because it only works in women with a certain gene mutation. And all that work came out of intense modeling and scientific assessment. Now, that's the going deeper. Now, the going broader, I think we can consider a huge amount of databases. The NIH GenBank, for example, has proliferated enormous amounts of data. The FDA's Sentinel system also is proliferating and aiming for 100 million patients or subjects in the database. The Kaiser Permanente medical database is the world's largest electronic health record database, with over 8.5 million current members, 20 million past members, and a 40-year time span. So the explosion of data will be put to use and expand modeling and simulation opportunities. I'd like to alert you to one, and I was a little blown away by this, but one of the most famous systems biologists, Lee Hood, at a meeting I was at just a couple of weeks ago, expressed the view that in systems biology there will be an ability to simulate an entire human cell as early as in 10 years' time. At the same time, think that molecular medicine, in a general sense, is expanding knowledge probably at the same rate as Moore's Law, which, remember, doubled the data processing capability of a transistor every 18 months. So we have an extraordinary here proliferation of opportunity that feeds back in to modeling and simulation, having real-world impact, rather like the Dreamliner is having impact on our transportation. Now, these developments will create an expanding need for biostatistics. And I think biostatisticians will advance on two different frontiers. First, a greater understanding at the molecular level, which really pushes a more deterministic approach that drives a deeper understanding of causality. And then a more stochastic approach on the broader side, where there's less detailed understanding, but more a broad population understanding and the need to assess more probabilistic views and uncertainty within the whole approach. Both those, the deterministic and the stochastic approach, will be part of the framework of biostatistics modeling. Okay, let's jump now to a few examples, which I think examples always expand my mind in how I think of certain things. First of all, though, let's talk about mastering complexity and improving predictability, which is really what we'd like to do in healthcare, by using the example of forecasting the weather. Now, the forecasting of the weather is still not a perfect science, but the progress made is enormous through mainly land-based data gathering. The next step is to bring ocean and sea-based data gathering, and once all these data are fully accumulated, it is thought that we will have the wherewithal then to predict the weather at the more molecular level, which I've been referring to as part of molecular medicine. So supercomputers prepare the way for this, and certainly within weather forecasting, one can see over the next 20 years or so, as more oceanic data become available and more data capture systems are put in place, weather forecasting will be a much better science. I would, in this, like to make, though, a couple of definitions. Modeling, I tend to use the term as looking backward, using existing data to describe systems or phenomena. And simulation, more looking forward, using a model to predict outcomes under the what-if assumptions. So now, some more tangible examples. Let's first of all have a look at deeper knowledge. Amgen researchers, a biotechnology company, one of the largest, have used multiple data streams to identify a gene mutation that predicts which patients will benefit from EGFR inhibitor drugs. And this has huge implications for patient targeting for a potential cancer drug. So Herceptin would be an example of how that sort of information was used. Let's now look at a broader example instead of going deeper into molecular medicine. And here simulations to assess health outcomes. The American Diabetes Association used a simulated trial to compare effects of current care and lifestyle management on long-term diabetes incidence and cost in a high-risk population. Now, what they did a validation of a three-year trial by simulating that three-year trial and then used that data to project 30 years. Now, on the validation of the three-year trial, they came within very tiny percentages of the actual outcomes of the trial. And when that had been accomplished, the results of the 30-year simulated trial gave a 30-year probability of a person in the study developing diabetes as about 71%, but with lifestyle modification, that relative risk was reduced to 15%. Now, given that diabetes is one of the dramatic scourges of modern-day health, those sorts of modeling situations can have obviously huge implications in preventive programs, which strike, I think, at the very heart of public health. The next example we did at Quintiles ourselves, this was a clinical development program design. We used available data that quantified possible risks for a central nervous system drug. Safety outcome scenarios were posed for various doses to inform program decision making. And this then enabled more efficient decisions on the development of that particular program. Now, the next example that I want to show you is an obesity target, and this is multidimensional screening. In the UK, there's a modeling group known as Crescent, and they build multidimensional structural models. And Crescent built a multidimensional model of how chemicals bind to a target enzyme that's linked to obesity. And one model screened a virtual database of 3.8 million compounds to find 500 hits to inhibit an obesity target enzyme. Such simulations and modeling have profound effects on the cost of drug development. Now, a further example. In drug development, dose is probably the single most important thing to get right. And it's very, very easy to get wrong. As you know, too high a dose causes toxicity, and too low a dose fails to have the therapeutic effect. And pharmacokinetic data have been used to predict dose regimens for more than a decade. And pharmacokinetic and pharmacodynamic dose modeling is the most advanced modeling and simulation application in drug development. Now here, this example, I think, is quite surprising for human public health policy. And this is an example where the FDA built a model and did a simulation to approve a pediatric dose of Premivir in the 2008 flu pandemic. Now, Premivir is an antiviral drug, and it was only studied in adult subjects. And there's a lot of questions about how much should be studied in young children. And of course, that does hinder many drugs being able to be given with safe labeling to young children. Now, during the H1N1 flu pandemic, the FDA saw urgent need for safe pediatric antiviral therapy. They modeled and simulated a study to identify and then approved a pediatric dose. And later, clinical trials were conducted in children, and the results were very close to the FDA's simulated outcomes. So we're already seeing examples where decisions are made on modeling and they haven't actually been done in real life, and that's in the arena of public policy. Another one that we've done at Quintiles is in sickle cell anemia. We used modeling and a simulation trial data to identify a dose that would provide pain relief for sickle cell patients on day one rather than on day seven of the actual trial. And these data were built out of phase one data that was that patients were originally exposed to. So again, a way of designing a protocol to exclude pain, which is a very serious issue in sickle cell anemia, as I'm sure you're aware. Now, a more a financial one, perhaps, in the biopharmaceutical industry. To model and simulate, This one is in portfolio management. And here, the simulation addresses more complex factors to improve portfolio decisions. Now, a portfolio would be many drugs as part of a group. And we at Quintiles have created a statistical model of a drug sponsor's development portfolio and then simulated various changes and their impact on the outcomes of the investment in all of the portfolio. Now, this has a lot of implications to the jobs, I would say, of biostatisticians, because there's a risk aversion at the moment inherent in investment in development of new drugs. And that risk aversion is a turnaround from the 1990s. And so if Monte Carlo simulations can be used to more accurately predict the risk attached to a whole portfolio, then of course more investment and then in turn more jobs in that sector will be created. So there really is a direct implication, I think, for jobs for people in this room. Now, the last example I would like to give here is from a group known as Archimedes. Now, Archimedes is a healthcare modeling company based in San Francisco. And they've modeled a Medicare population and simulated trials to predict 30-year outcomes. They've modeled a representative population using data on real Medicare patients to create clones person by person. They ran simulated trials of 14 different prevention activities and of all the activities together. The activities included smoking cessation, exercise, diet to reduce body mass, and high blood pressure. So things very near to the heart of public health. The findings were, if prevention efforts continue at today's level, myocardial infarction will roughly double over the next 30 years. But if used together, all the preventions could in turn reduce myocardial infarction by 75%. And the two most effective were body mass index and cholesterol. So again, very real public health implications, which have a huge implication in how we model out healthcare expenditures in the future. Now, what is encouraging, I think, in all this, is that the FDA has been an ardent supporter of modeling and simulation. You may have heard of the Clinical Path Initiative, and that does cite modeling and simulation. Also, the end of phase 2A meetings that FDA holds on the use of or how to progress, there's a lot of guidance to recommend the use of trial simulation for better dose response estimation. And that answers one of the key questions in drug development: what is the right dose? As you may also be aware, drugs are often metabolized in the liver, and so drug-induced liver injury, and that's the DILI that you see there, is a very important aspect, and there's a lot of initiatives to simulate that based on pharmacodynamic and pharmacokinetic data. In the UK, there's also a lot of encouragement through healthcare technology assessments that are going on in the UK. And so I think it's extremely important that regulatory agencies are encouraging this deployment of models and simulation, and as I said earlier, sometimes making public policy on the basis of it. There are, though, economic barriers. There will be additional upfront time and cost if one does a lot of modeling and simulation. You have to often spend it on the front end to reduce costs on the back end. There's also, I think, a lot of operational barriers. There's going to be a lot of cross-functional requirements of data from many different arenas. And biostatisticians often work in sequence rather than in integrated operations. So I think the cross-functional partnerships will be very important. And of course, tremendous quality concerns, because I purposely used the example of the weather. Obviously, when something has not quite got to the level that it's almost perfect, it also makes a lot of errors. And I think the weather is a good example of how a lot of progress is being made, but you don't fulfill total accuracy until you make a huge amount of progress in the ability to model and simulate. And that, in many cases in medicine, will come out of the molecular medicine knowledge of molecular pathways. So now, let's look a little more at a future view. Because I think healthcare, as I've alluded to earlier, is entering quite a difficult stage. It's huge in presidential elections. It's a huge sort of controversy in the United States. And most of the arguments revolve around money. And so value-driven medicine and value-driven drug development, because the pharmaceutical industry is experiencing a huge amount of negatives, partly because it's not producing the right amount of productivity, and in turn, there's a lack of willingness to make the investments that will further the science that the last 20 years has brought about with intense knowledge through genetics and related factors. So evidence-driven drug development and evidence-based medicine will, I think, move us to the next level. The cost of clinical trials has indeed risen immensely. And of course, so now many more people are asking the question, can we do simulation to compensate and not need as many clinical trials as we've done in the past? Many people, though, will have to get new ways of working. And I think management will be one of the skills that many biostatisticians will need more of in order to further mass modeling and simulation endeavors. So biostatisticians, project managers, clinicians, preclinical scientists, pharmacologists, epidemiologists, marketers, economists, and regulatory experts all will play a role in some of the grander modeling and simulation exercises. Now, the impact of modeling and simulation in healthcare, there's another example that I'd like to show here, how it has influenced, again, national policy. And here, this is in the case of Ireland, and their colorectal screening. And here the issue was around what are the costs and benefits of disease screening. Ireland's Health Technology Assessment, that's Ireland's HTA, evaluated effectiveness of options for colorectal cancer screening. It's the second most common cancer in men and women. An average of 2,000 new cases and 9,000 deaths a year in the country of Ireland alone. Now, modeling and simulation was used to compare outcomes with and without screening programs. Modeled resource requirements and health outcomes over the first 10 years of the proposed screening program were evaluated, and the results identified by screening every 2 years in the 55 to 74 year age group as an optimal strategy for reducing mortality rates. So again, directly affecting public policy and the financing of public policy. Now let me make a comment about turning data into intelligence. It took 10 to maybe 13 years to sequence the first human genome. But within 5 to 10 years, we'll be able to sequence a gene probably in minutes at a cost of less than $100. I think the original sequencing was a cost of something like $4.6 billion. So that is amazing. I mean, and that I think is staggering from the point of view of the amount of data that then will begin to be processed in relatively short spaces of time. It also staggers the mind on how biostatistics is going to handle this exponential growth of data with huge, huge numbers of variables. I was interested, though, I compared some of that with how I've got into statistics in my own lifetime. I was originally trained where we did analysis of variance on the old adding machines, and some of you may remember that. When computers started to be used more regularly, it did transform our ability to practice the science of statistics. I think that in the early part of my training, you sort of did theory, and then you only did the actual examples on more simple things. Just to invert a matrix was a huge, huge problem. Now, of course, once computers in the late 60s started to be used very frequently, but by the 70s, and of course enabled topics like logistic regression to be easily applied. Now that shows the transformation then that computing had on the practice of statistics itself. I think this next evolution is the transformation that statistics and modeling has on the ability to drive information. And I think that is going to be extraordinarily powerful. But let's add one further thing here, and that's the power of connectivity. And here, Bill Gates, maybe one of the major architects of connectivity. The magical thing is this network dramatically increases the number of brilliant minds we can have working together on the same problem. And that scales up the rate of innovation to a staggering degree. And so the connectivity of biostatisticians, I think, can ramp up the ability to model and simulate almost any aspect of biological endeavor. Now, an example of connectivity is very interesting. Video games solved a puzzle that had stumped AIDS researchers for years, and you may have read about this recently. The FoldIt program, created by the University of Washington, translates scientific problems into competitive computer games. Online gamers playing on FoldIt deciphered the structure of a retrovirus in just 3 weeks. Structural breakthrough may lead then to new drug designs and new treatment designs. So that, I believe, is quite remarkable, how the power of connectivity can solve a problem that the best researchers have not necessarily been able to solve. Now, biostatistics, though, will need access to quality assured data in a very timely manner, well documented, but they will probably have to fight because transparency of data often gets protected by the people that own the data. And of course, many of the things I have said will only work if data become much more transparent and open source. But that will beget other issues around privacy that will also need to be tackled. So there are a number of needs and a number of issues surrounding the ability of biostatisticians to further all the things I've talked about. Data standards will also be more necessary. They're necessary at the moment. They will continue to become more and more necessary if we're merging more and more databases. And this will include the standards of definitions and the standards of programs that handle all this. So there's a lot of administrative and logistical issues as well as social issues that do get wrapped up in the modeling and simulation that I'm talking about. Analytics, I think, will also have to jump up the scale. There will have to be better search skills that I've talked about earlier. More, perhaps, in the spirit of artificial intelligence, like IBM's Watson, that's a computer or computer system that defeated human players on Jeopardy. And so that sort of thing, I believe, is where more and more data analytics is going. So IBM's Watson, there was a computer system, if you're not familiar, that understands natural language questions and delivers precise answers. And the first commercial use of Dr. Watson may well be to answer diagnostic and treatment questions, and maybe to access huge libraries of medical information, tailored then ultimately to receive huge amounts of electronic health record information. And that does bring a very important point, because electronic health records, which are already coming about, but will become about more and more, will open up, obviously subject to privacy, but with anonymization of those, may open up huge amounts of data that avail themselves of modeling and simulation on a very, very grand scale. Now, in this environment, I'm not sure we have enough biostatisticians. If we think of medicine and also drug development, through necessity of the value that society is demanding, moving more and more to modeling and simulation and more to evidence basis for things, I think the 22,000 odd US statisticians that the US Bureau of Labor Statistics listed relatively recently would not be an adequate labor force to deal with all this. In addition, I think the training may have to change. There will have to be more intuition, more logic, a lot of mathematical skills, but also more management talent to bring off some of the vision that I've tried to outline with the potential that's being brought about and the modeling that we've seen in other arenas. So, the new role, I believe, for biostatisticians is to lead the conversation, facilitate discussion across disciplines, drive modeling and simulation processes across functions, guide modeling and simulation informed decision making. And I think if that is done, we may come closer to the medicine tomorrow that cannot be brought about unless budgets go through the roof, or unless we bring more skills so that we're able to screen potential drugs in virtual biosystems, evaluate therapies in virtual patients, and predict real-world health outcomes and costs. So thank you. I think that's indeed at the spirit of public health, and the quantitative roots of what I've said are immense and I think bring enormous opportunity. Thank you. Do you normally have Q&A, or is that the plan?
Yes, we have plenty of time for questions, comments, discussion.
Just small comment. I agree totally with what you said. A small portion, I just disagree with you. I know that biostatistician, they need more data management skills, more simulation skills, which is mean math. You said little math. In fact, they need more math to have the skill of, because I'm a simulation person, so I use Monte Carlo, CFC methods, bootstrapping, all the kind of methods. So without my complete math training background, I wouldn't be that able to do this kind of modeling and simulation. So I think we need more math.
A lot more math skills.
Yeah.
The only comment I would make there, we've got to be a little careful that we don't eliminate out the people with intuition and vision. And I actually think these things won't come about through one person. I think they'll come about through teams. And I would agree with you, the team must have a math expert. No question. Yeah, no question. I always used to practice with Gary Cook, and he would more the technical expert, and I was more the applications guy. And we made a good team together.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Very visionary. We appreciate that. I do have a comment, actually a question, I guess. When you turn back the clock, the Census Bureau, the federal government, and the population at large has been fairly slow in embracing sampling rather than a census. It seems to me like what you're talking about with simulation is analogous, at least to the FDA, who has traditionally had their own set of quantitative methods that they've always used. How do you see us overcoming the momentum of traditional statistics and embracing simulation, and how are the pharmaceutical companies embracing simulation as well as FDA?
Well, it's interesting. Let me take a very simple thing, which is big in my own business, and that's monitoring of clinical trials. That has always been universal, like you need to do it all, 100%. But the FDA has just come out with guidance under the rubric of what's called centralized monitoring, which is based on sampling processes and monitoring those cases where you have evidence that there's a higher risk. Some people call it risk-based monitoring. So it's akin to the sampling that you're talking about. I do believe with more modeling and simulation, we'll understand better the right things to sample or the right ways to sample, and indeed then generate a greater power than we have maybe in things like censuses. Now, of course, the census is a real case in point, because we can get more accurate census data by using sampling methods to figure out the missing people. But of course, Congress won't allow that. And so there are sometimes blocks in the sheer logic of laws, but I think sampling in general, and I think that's another important example, can provide more accurate information than counting.
That's a good question. How do we get the university to change their method of preparation to address your problem?
Well, you know, that's interesting, because I was in a department of biostatistics for many years and have been and worked with a number of universities agitating for, I think, education that more looks to the future of a knowledge-based society. I think there's a lot of resistance to that because a lot of faculty were not on as strong a ground as some of the theory that they've been trained in. But I do think the notion of partnering with industry, having internships, the notion of maybe bringing in other people on faculty for temporary periods, a lot more open source in terms of the sorts of things that need to be taught. I think those directions will bring that about, because I do believe a knowledge-based society like the US is, and where I come from in the UK is the same, and I make the same arguments there. The educational systems, if they don't push the sorts of things that will create knowledge-based jobs, then we are going to see the sorts of things we're seeing right at the moment, where there's often a lack of jobs, and that lack of jobs may be in part because the right educational levels and the right sorts of things are not being given to the appropriate people. So I think that's a huge social question. Asia is responding to that question far better, I believe, than the United States is. And that is again a case of social policy. Sir?
Yes, thank you, a great talk. Gets us very much out of the myriad of Greek letters and numerals I see. But specifically, could you comment, if possible, on the recent decision by IOM, about the anthrax vaccine in children, and could modeling and simulation have, or did it help them make that decision not to go forward with the trials?
Yeah, I must admit, I don't know the answer to that. In that area, I can't recall off the top of my head. It would depend on the degree to which we have the right pharmacokinetic and pharmacodynamic modeling of the way that operates, and I'm not sure about that. But I do believe if we understand the modeling in that sense, the metabolism, then and we've got some human data, then I would say
just like one of the examples I gave, the answer would be yes. Whether there's an animal system where one could interpolate from if one didn't have any adults, data, that would also be possible, as long as animal writers didn't object to squirting some anthrax. But I think the answer is very likely.
I'll move over here. Can we turn that off? I don't think we need that, aren't there? No, I didn't. Don't worry. Sir?
I enjoyed your talk very much, and I think...
Yeah, one of the examples came out of your university.
Yes, and I was aware of that video itself. It was shown to us, and it was exciting. They're an exciting group of people there. One other thing, I just want to take a slightly different take on this, and which is of course, modeling and simulation is an integral part of of the biostatistician's life today, in almost every field that we work in. But there is a concern that you talk about these virtual systems, and more what some people like to call computer modeling, if I may use that term broadly, into doing science. But there is a major concern, I think, in large parts of academia, that how sensitive and how reliable the designs of these computer experiments are, and it is very easy to perhaps go wrong with these, and that may lead to really wrong and perhaps catastrophically wrong conclusions. And especially with medical science, this is going to be very important. If I may just add one more point, I mean, I actually had the opportunity, and it was a very nice opportunity to take a close look at, how fire spread in California. This is not public health, but it was environmental. So the reason I said that we were able to experiment more with that because they were not we were doing this in a virtual world. We didn't have to worry about human lives immediately. I guess. I mean, it was just the physics going in there, but there were a group of physicists who were developing these computer systems with how fires are spreading, wildfires spreading, and so that the State Department of California can react properly to that. And it was all modeling and simulation, and they wanted to do some statistics and so on. But it turned out that the computer systems they had, they were extremely sensitive to the inputs into that system. And you change the inputs, and suddenly the path of the fire being predicted is completely different, drastically different from what it was with a different set of inputs. And those inputs are very, very subjective, and subjective in the sense there's not much information about those inputs. And so you have to be very careful what we have to do. And so this is something that sure. that I just wanted to share.
Well, first of all, I would say there's no intent to mean that modeling and simulation will be the answer. I believe it's a crawling peg system where you do some modeling and simulation to help you design a better experiment or study, and then you validate, and then you gradually build up, partly through a trial and error process. So the whole spirit of my comments were in that spirit, and I would be absolutely agree with you. However, remember, to get a new drug approved, you often expose 5,000 patients or more, maybe 20,000. I would say maybe one could expose 100 possibly in the future and use modeling and simulation to amplify in certain selected situations where you knew the molecular pathways, not in something where that was totally unknown. So I think it's that. It's cutting the costs and amplifying the knowledge rather than totally replacing. Sir?
Yeah, I'm sorry I was late, by the way. It was a great talk. I you said teamwork. That was really important. And I wanted to ask a question regarding, certain about how teams collaborate to formulate new models and things of that nature. I come to work for Abbott Laboratories, and I'm in a biometrics group. And I work in early phase for the clinical trials, so I do a lot of PK data. And QTC is a very important mm-hmm. thing to measure dealing with cardiology. So as Can simulation possibly be a big focal point in the situation that in studying that in that type of study?
I think it could.
They already have their standardized way of, okay, you model QTC doing this and that, but what, it may not work for every single study. So with me being a lowly research statistician as a starter, I can't tell them, don't do it this way or whatnot. So is there any way you can kind of, you know, have someone to bring up to say, well, is there any way you can put up a presentation and let you know, okay, well, you may need to do some background simulation showing that maybe this is not the way to do it anymore. Maybe go this route for some of the
simple. We certainly use a lot of software to identify QTC aberrations and, you know, anticipate whether there would be black box warnings on the labeling. So I think the answer is yes, no question. I would at the same time say what we do in our own business is bring cardiologists in as in the background to review on a sampling basis what the software says. And there would be gradations. If the software is clear-cut and adamant, we would sample a tiny fraction of those. If it's more in a gray zone, we'd sample a higher fraction, rather like the comment over there. So in my own business, that's the approach we use at the moment. But it is very critical. This is all to do with cardiac safety related to drugs. And if there's certain things that the EKG shows up, you get what's known as a black box warning on your labeling. So,
just going backwards in time instead of forwards, what's the origin of the name quintiles?
What's the origin of quantitative information technology in the life and economic sciences? First letters. Well,